Listen, there's a great work to be done. As soon as you win this court battle, you must deliver this message. Take advantage of this opportunity and declare a powerful message to this world. He expects more of us. He believes we can do more. Who's going to stop Christ? Who's going to stop Christ from getting this work done?
This is Behind the Work.
Welcome to Behind the Work. I'm Grant Turgeon. I'm actually recording this episode in advance from the Herbert W. Armstrong College here in Edmond, Oklahoma, online at kpcg.fm. You can find all the episodes there. Because by the time this episode plays, I will be exploring the great American Southwest on vacation. So I thought, since I'd missed a few chances to go on the radio recently with some chest congestion that affected my voice, I would at least record a couple of programs for the week that I would be out of town. Today we'll be getting back into the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong. This is a book that is available for free at thetrumpet.com. This is a book all about the life experiences of God's end time Elijah. It is such a blessing to have a book like this to explain to us, to prove to us, God's intimate involvement in his entire life from the beginning. He did have a lot of memorable experiences in his early years that prepared him to be the physical leader of God's work in the sixth church era. He starts out here in chapter 11. Today we'll cover chapters 11 through 13. But he starts out in chapter 11, titled Our First Child, talking about living on the north side of Chicago for a while after his wedding, and then moving to the south side. I have a lot of Chicago friends. Some of them are fans of the Cubs baseball team from the north side. Others are friends of the, or fans of the White Sox on the south side. And Mr. Armstrong lived on both sides of the city. So I guess it's hard to pick a favorite there. However, Mr. Armstrong's wife didn't like the city very much, sadly. Mr. Armstrong writes, Mrs. Armstrong had formed an intense aversion to the artificial and mechanical city of Chicago. So I'm very sorry to all of you from Chicago who love the city that I had to read that to you, but I did think it was amusing. I got the chance to take my family to Chicago just last year, toward the end of the year, and actually really enjoyed it. But the first time I went back in 2015, I didn't like it so much. So I guess it just depends on where you go, what you do, your familiarity with the area a little bit. I'm not naturally too comfortable in the big city most of the time anyway, so that probably skewed my first experience. Well, Mr. Armstrong, as the chapter indicates, talks about his experience, his first child. There's a subhead here that's titled, A Father Suffers Birth Pangs. Now, of course, usually it's the mother who literally experiences those painful sensations before giving birth. But Mr. Armstrong experienced, you could say, mental and emotional birth pangs. He writes here, I just caught the Rock Island train for Des Moines on the run. So he's rushing back. He finds out that his wife is due to give birth 2 weeks before her due date. So he's taking a train back into town from a business trip. And he says, but the train didn't seem to run. It seemed to slow down to a slow walk. Why didn't that train go a little faster? It didn't seem in any hurry. It made all the stops. Time dragged. My nerves raced. The suspense built up. I don't think we arrived in Des Moines at 6 that same night. I think it was at 6 several nights later. At least so it seemed to me. So it was a really frantic time for him. And as he goes on to explain, he was way more concerned about his wife and how she felt afterward. He didn't even know if she would live through the experience. So Mr. Armstrong had quite a lot of fear and worry about his first child being born, especially about his wife's welfare. That does contrast quite a bit. My experience back in mid-2017 with Loma being born, my wife just came to me one night and politely informed me that her water had broken. And then we went to the hospital and we were just holding hands in the car on the way there and chatting about life. And she was totally relaxed, which made sure that I was totally relaxed. Then we got into the hospital, checked her into her room, and turned on the news on TV and just talked about the news. My family was there for almost the entire time, too. And then about 12 hours later, Loma was born. And it just seemed like a very relaxed experience, especially compared to poor Mr. Armstrong and a lot of other stories I've heard where it didn't go nearly that smoothly. And I can just only hope and pray that our second time having a child around this summer hopefully goes as smoothly as the first one, where we're just totally at ease as if we're not even about to have a child. It's funny here, talking about new mothers too. Mr. Armstrong writes, "Whenever the baby made a sound, Mrs. Armstrong was sure she was choking to death. When she did not make a sound, my wife was sure she had smothered to death." A lot to learn, a lot of fears, because obviously babies are so helpless and they need so much assistance and a lot of diligent attention paid to them so that they grow and develop the right way and without any complications. And it does take some know-how and some wisdom on the behalf of the parents or on the part of the parents to make sure that the children turn out okay. Mr. Armstrong talks about the flu and how in 1918 a flu epidemic broke out. Mr. Armstrong's solution for this was to avoid moving back into Chicago. So they moved out to Iowa for their baby to be born, their first daughter. And then they were thinking about moving back into Chicago, but especially with that flu outbreak, he didn't want to go back into the congestion of the big city. A lot of diseases seem to start in big cities. We have the coronavirus right now. China has far more million population cities than any other nation in the world. So with all those people stacked on top of each other, with the poor hygiene that often comes along with that type of population density, obviously the more frequent contact with people, and in some cases just not knowing some of the health laws, not knowing what to eat or certain other hygiene laws, it really can cause diseases to proliferate. So it wasn't a matter of getting a bunch of shots. It was more just staying out of the big city for a while until the flu epidemic passed. And then a bit after that, Mr. Armstrong moved back into the south side of Chicago. So then to my Chicago friends on the south side, they get the advantage there. If you care what went on with Mr. Armstrong. Well, Mr. Armstrong continues talking as well about how he was this publisher's representative for some major bankers' journals, and he would be dealing with a lot of businessmen who wanted to sell their product into these magazines, put ads in these bankers' journals, basically pitching their products to the bankers. And a big part of that was tractor manufacturers putting ads into those bankers' journals so that the bankers would stop convincing all their farmer clients not to buy tractors. If the bankers were convinced that these tractors were worthwhile, they would then go ahead and tell their farmer clients that it would be a good idea for them to get their own personal tractor. So Mr. Armstrong was right in the middle of all this negotiation. He was the one coming up with these fresh new advertising ideas and ways to make sure that the bankers and the tractor manufacturers and the farmers were all in agreement. And it really did lead to a lot more business, a lot more money, and a lot more productivity for all of them. Pretty valuable experience for Mr. Armstrong. He said, "I soon learned, however, that it was difficult to induce the head of a great corporation with national distribution to advertise in one small bank journal covering only five states. They were accustomed to doing business in a big way, of national scope. I think I must have caught some of their vision. Later, when the media of radio and the printing press were open to me in the Great Commission, it seemed natural that my thinking was constantly along lines of expansion, first from Lane County, Oregon, to the Portland area, then the entire Pacific Northwest, then California and the entire coast, then national, then finally, as of today, worldwide. I think my readers will be quick to grasp how these years of business training provided the necessary foundation for the great work of today." So you can see there, Mr. Armstrong always thought big. He never limited God in doing the work. And he learned that early on in his business dealings with these successful men. And Mr. Armstrong realized he needed to go to a national scope in his business dealings if he was going to have success dealing with these successful men. He needed to represent more national bankers' journals. And he ended up representing the nine biggest ones. But Mr. Armstrong does admit that he had a problem with being a streaky worker at times. He says, "In those days, I worked sporadically in streaks. I seemed to have my off days and my on days. When I was on, I was red hot. And as I fancied, at least, very brilliant. But on the off days, it seemed I couldn't sell anything. I became very uncomfortably aware of this great fault. And I tried to fight it, but it took me years to overcome it. But I did overcome it eventually." And he obviously was very thankful that he didn't have to work more than 4 or 5 days a month, because selling ad space like he did was pretty lucrative. You get several big contracts, and you don't have to be on every day of the month. But in most jobs, you do have to be on every day. And Mr. Armstrong had to learn that consistency over time. And I think if we all really examine our own lives, it's pretty obvious to us why we might be on some days versus off on other days. For me personally, at least, it always comes back to my relationship with God, how well, how fervently, how hard I prayed, how much detail I put into my prayers, how excited I was about Bible study and meditation. And when those things are all really good on a given day, it just seems like my focus is way better than it normally is. And I have more specific goals going about the day. And I'm just motivated. I'm more excited. I look forward to my responsibilities with wholeheartedness, with eagerness, not fear and hesitation. So I think that's something that probably most of you can relate to as well. God really does provide the power in this Christian walk to do what sometimes we wouldn't naturally want to do the hard things, even when the tendency is to relax and take it easy. Mr. Armstrong developed a reputation as a publisher's representative who knew his stuff. The people who worked with him also found out that Mr. Armstrong was absolutely honest when he made statements about his own bank journals or about his competition. He was totally honest. He made recommendations according to the truth and not what would benefit him the most personally, if it meant sacrificing honesty and integrity. And this really did come up quite a lot. As we've talked about before, and as you know, business is often extremely cutthroat in the world. And people are willing to step on the neck of competition just to get ahead. People are willing to burn bridges, ruin friendships and strong relationships just to make a little bit more money in many cases. Mr. Armstrong simply refused to do that. And in some cases, like one story he talks about later in the autobiography, I believe it's actually in this very next chapter, chapter 12, when he had a chance to develop, or I guess keep strong relationships with 7 leading tractor manufacturers by lying, he did not take them up on that offer. He did not want to convince the bankers, to convince the farmers to buy tractors during the recession. Mr. Armstrong knew that those farmers simply would not have been smart to buy tractors during that time. And he was not about to try to make a deal with these businessmen that would force these farmers to make bad decisions with their finances. Mr. Armstrong thought about the well-being of the clients, even though he could have secured massive advertising contracts from those leading tractor manufacturers. So Mr. Armstrong was willing to facilitate deals between the manufacturers and the farmers whenever those deals would actually benefit everybody. But when it came to deceiving one party into making a terrible personal decision, Mr. Armstrong simply didn't want any part of it. And that really is admirable, because this is years before Mr. Armstrong was ever called to God's truth. Even back then, he had a sense of real integrity, even in the face of some pretty strong persuasion to go the other way sometimes. There's a really nice teaching lesson here in chapter 12 titled Depression Strikes. He had invited his 20-year-old brother Russell to come work with him in advertising. Mr. Armstrong was 28 years old at the time. Russell started out kind of struggling a little bit to make sales, to sell advertising space. But Mr. Armstrong decided, well, I will take my brother on a sales call with me, and I will really make sure I'm keyed up and I put on the best show I can so that Russell is impressed by the way I make this sale. So Mr. Armstrong strode into that business office confidently with his brother alongside him. He spoke with bold, confident assurance. He was prepared for everything his counterpart asked him for. He handed out all the documents that were requested instead of having to go back and prepare those documents for another meeting. And he really did convince that other person of his case. And he made a record-breaking sale at this time. He signed a massive contract. But then, when Mr. Armstrong asked his brother, well, did that experience help you, Russ? He writes here, I was completely surprised at his answer. No, it certainly didn't. Instead, it showed me why I haven't been landing any contracts. Look, Herb, I'm only 20 years old. They think of me as just a kid. You are 28. You've been in this for years, and you've had experience I haven't had. You have all the facts right on your tongue tip. You speak with assurance and authority. You know your stuff. And men you talk to know that you know your stuff. They have confidence in you immediately. But I don't have all this knowledge yet. And I don't appear as mature. And I can't talk as confidently. Mr. Armstrong continues, I was disappointed. To try to help my brother, I had really keyed myself up to put on a good show for him on this call. It boomeranged. It reacted in reverse. It discouraged him. And I didn't know what to do about it. This is really a valuable teaching lesson, I think. Obviously, most of the time, teachers are far advanced in the particular subject in comparison to their students. And it can be easy for teachers to forget just how easy the subject now comes to them because they've had years of working and growing in understanding of the subject. But, for example, if I was at some sort of a basketball camp and the NBA player in charge of the camp is trying to explain certain moves, and he's doing windmill dunks and he's shooting threes from half court, and he's like, see how easy that is? Why don't you go ahead and do it? Maybe that would be a little bit discouraging. I think on the one hand, I would be motivated to try to get better myself, but I would also know, well, that level for me personally is probably unattainable. I probably can't just go out and execute the top level skills of a professional player right away from that first practice. And that's sort of how Russell viewed it with his brother Herbert. Russell didn't really see how he could ever get that good at selling like Herbert had just displayed. So we do have to really start with the fundamentals, start with the basics, and help our students build from that. Sometimes if we show them the finished product and act like that's so easy, it can be easy for the students instead to think, well, how can I possibly ever reach that level? I don't even know anything about this yet. How can I possibly be this good? So that's just something to consider when it comes to teaching there, I think. Well, the Depression did strike in 1920. Sure enough, Mr. Armstrong and a lot of his business colleagues were warned about this before it happened. But they didn't believe it because at the time the economy was booming. And that's when this renowned statistician, Roger Babson, returned to another business conference the next year in 1921. So he had warned about the coming depression in 1920. No one believed him. Then he comes back in 1921 and he explains how exactly he knew that the depression would strike. Roger Babson said at this conference, "It is now midwinter. If I want to know what the temperature is now in this room, I go to the wall and look at the thermometer. If I want to know what it has been up to now and the existing trend as of the moment, I look at a recording thermometer. But if I want to know what the temperature in this room is going to be an hour from now, I go to the source which determines future temperatures. I go down to the boiler room and see what is happening down there." He says to these businessmen, "You looked at the thermometers on the wall. I looked at the way people as a whole were dealing with one another. I looked to the source which determines future conditions. I have found that that source may be defined in terms of righteousness." This is a statistician talking. "When 51% or more of the whole people are reasonably righteous in their dealings with one another, we are heading into increasing prosperity. When 51% of the people become unrighteous in their business dealings with their fellows, then we are headed for bad times economically." And Mr. Armstrong responds to that, "I paid with the loss of my business to learn the lesson." So Mr. Armstrong himself did have integrity, but in that business world where the vast majority of people were just looking out for themselves, he was set up for failure. When his big business contracts fell through because his clients' businesses failed, Mr. Armstrong's business naturally fell apart as a result. But look what he says there. When 51% of the people are righteous, you do have a little bit of hope. But then when the majority becomes unrighteous, when the majority forsakes God, like we see all the time in the world today, we're headed for quite a lot of trouble. Mr. Armstrong really struggled from 1920 through 1922. He called them discouraging years. Chapter 13 of his autobiography is titled Business Disintegrates. And this is just really sad to read about. And it does show that at least Mr. Armstrong held fast to his principles. When his business collapsed, he couldn't support his family anymore. He couldn't keep his business going. He couldn't afford even a one-room apartment living on his own while the rest of his family lived with her father. And that was a really humbling experience for him. But these hard experiences really did prepare him for much success in the future. I'll just conclude today with one humorous story in the midst of chapter 13, which is pretty sobering overall. But there is this funny story about Mr. Armstrong's eldest daughter, Beverly, how she was very quick to inform her father that she was a big girl now. And then they went to breakfast one morning, and Beverly gave her order to the waitress. She said, "I think I will have some ice cream, some string beans, and some candy." And then later on, her younger sister, Dorothy, had a similar experience at dinner. She said, "I want some ice cream, popcorn, and some chewing gum." Mr. Armstrong points out, "I never did quite agree with the modernistic psychologists who say we should always give children whatever they want, that they instinctively know what is best for them." You see the ill effects that that wrong way of thinking from psychologists has on society. It has gotten so extreme today where children who one day think that they are a fireman, the next day think they're a ballerina, the next day they think they're a giraffe, somehow should have the authority to decide their gender and what clothes they wear. And that can really ruin them for life if parents just go along with that crazy way of thinking. Mr. Armstrong knew this way before these latest trends became popular. So today we've been talking about chapters 11 through 13 of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong. A lot of great lessons, and you really see Mr. Armstrong coming to the point where he's about to be humbled by God. He's about to be knocked down and forced by God to submit. Some great stories here, and hopefully from hearing these episodes about the autobiography, you will be motivated to start reading it too. Just an awesome book that you can get for free at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Grant Turgeon. This has been Behind the Work.
You've been listening to Behind the Work. Email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for a new episode each Monday at 11:30 a.m. Central Time.